Welcome, I'm Gary Parr, and you're listening to Fiber Talk, the twice-weekly podcast for needlework artists. Our artist this week is Helen McCook. Tremendous conversation with Helen. Going to get to that in just a minute, but first need to tell you about our two sponsors this week. The first one is the Embroiderers Guild of America, and that is at egausa.org, where you can learn about a tremendous organization that is full of education, opportunities, outreach, projects, you name it. Vaughn and I, as we've talked about several times, have joined the EGA because when we looked through the website, we saw just a tremendous growth and opportunity there to expand our needlework experiences, and encourage you to do the same. They have online classes, free projects, and as I've said before, be sure if you go to that gallery section, you have some time on your hands because you'll spend some time there, I guarantee you. Call your attention to two events coming up here. One is a beginning Brazilian dimensional embroidery with Judy Caruso, and that features the creation of a stitch sampler using many beginner-level dimensional stitches, including bullion and cast-on stitches. Registration ends August 31. And then the other one that I would like you to take a look at is Hidden Trellises with Marilyn Hazelwood, in which you'll stitch the trellising background and use a variety of stitches to incorporate flowers, allowing both the trellis and the flowers to shine. Registration for that ends August 26. So a little bit of time to get in on those things. And they're adding things all the time at the website there. So just put that, bookmark that thing, egausa.org. Bookmark that so that you can check in regularly. And give serious consideration to be a member. You don't have to join a local chapter either. You can do what Vaughn and I did and become a member at large and have all the benefits without feeling obligated to go to a meeting, or maybe you just don't have a chapter in your area and want to be a member of an organization of enthusiastic stitchers. So try that route. It works for Vaughn and me. And then whether you do a project from EGA or one of your own projects or just are looking for something new to stitch, be sure to call Kim at Sassy Jack Stitchery. Kim will fix you up there, sassyjackstitchery.com. And as we've talked about 1,000 times here, we have the Royal Garden project coming up, Stitch Along, Kim offering 15% off those kits. And July 5, we start that project with a live show at 2:00 Eastern time. Kim, Vaughn, and I will be stitching. And so if you're involved in that, want to do that project, get your kit if you don't already have it. Kim will get it out to you right away. And then you'll be able to join us on July 5 for a live show. And we'll be there to fumble and or help you. Fumble our own things and or help you. I'm not quite sure how that'll go. But anyway, you'll get help if you need help. Or you can just enjoy stitching with us. Also, be sure and check out Elizabeth Cooper, Jesus Wept, a sampler Kim put together for the quarantine period. That chart is free, and then, of course, she has kits available for that. And then if you've never done needlepoint, counted needlepoint, be sure and check out Kim's Boxed Heart project, which is a beginner project designed by Carol Lake and Michael Boren, and Kim is doing videos to help you with that, so you can get your feet wet before you dig into the Royal Garden. And then Kim is able now to open her store on a limited basis. So appointment shopping will begin July 1. So you have to call and she'll let you know how the appointment system works. She also is offering curbside service. And then shipping now is a $4 flat fee up to $50. Then it's free after that. And international is $15 flat fee. And then be sure to check out the Learning Stitches series. That is a tremendous series that you want to get involved in if you want to expand your stitching arsenal. And if nothing else, get the book, because the book is outstanding. So that's at sassyjackstitchery.com, and we appreciate support from Embroiderers Guild of America and Sassy Jacks for this show. And now we'll listen to Helen McCook. Helen McCook, thanks for joining us.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Oh, this is going to be fun. There isn't too much you haven't done, I'll say that.
Yes, it's been varied.
Yes. So word on the street is you got into this crazy world of needlework because a leaflet fell at your foot?
Absolutely. Yeah, kind of serendipity took a bit of a hand, I think. It's a funny one. I was at university and I was studying for a Bachelor of Arts degree in print and dyed textiles with non-European art history. And I'd been on work experience. I thought I was going to work using colour. I was going to work as a colourist for big printing companies and things. And so that was where my head was at. And I'd been on work experience whilst at university with a big industrial company, and they were brilliant. But the amount of people that were turning around and saying to me after a few days of being there, you know, it's a dying trade. It's, you know, everything's changing. You're not going to have a lifelong career. And they were kind of, you know, there was one person that took a good look at my face at that point and kind of realized what they were saying was having an impact. And they kind of really, really kindly took the time to kind of sit down and go, let's have a cup of tea and have a conversation. Very British. Let's have a cup of tea and a conversation. So we sat down and had a chat about it, and they were like, okay, there's so many people coming out of university these days, and people with very similar skill set. What is it about you that's going to make you the person that is employed within a job market that's becoming, it's reducing in size here in this particular field? And I just kind of said, you know what, that's a really good point. There's so many of us, we've all got a lot of talent and skills, and you know, it's other than attitude and aptitude and desire for the job, I mean, we're 10 a penny. There's a lot of us with the same kind of qualifications. So you're right, there's not a lot to pick between us, I wouldn't have thought. And and they kind of said, okay, so if you really, really want to go into textiles, then you really need to think about a niche skill that you can have, or a niche market, or another string to your bow. And I really valued that chance to kind of have a chance to stop and kind of look at what I was doing. You know, you get on the treadmill, you've gone through school and college and university, and you kind of like, you know, it's one after the other, and you kind of think you're on that path that you're going in. And this gave me an opportunity to kind of stop and think about it and really think about what I wanted and what would please me and how I could make that a functional role. And so, yeah, it sounds like a really boring conversation I had with myself there, but fate took a hand, really. So I went back to university to continue with my degree, which I wanted to complete. And I went into the careers library and was pulling out some information. I was actually looking at that time, the Victoria and Albert Museum in London had a textile conservation course that they used to teach. And I thought that that was potentially the direction that I wanted to go in. I pulled out some information regarding that, and a leaflet dropped on my feet, and it was for the Royal School of Needlework for the apprenticeship that they ran at the time. And I kind of picked it up and looked at it and thought, what's this? And I didn't stitch, so I didn't have any knowledge of embroidery at all. And I just kind of thought, I've never heard of this place. Hang on, did a bit of homework, and I kind of looked into it and I thought, crikey, this sounds interesting. So I ended up having two interviews with them and got accepted onto the apprenticeship. So I was still in my third year at university. And I knew I was going straight into the apprenticeship course once I'd graduated. So that was another 3 years full time as an apprentice. And it was based at Hampton Court Palace. And it was just an incredible, incredible moment where you kind of, your future just takes a left turn. And it completely moulded my absolute obsession and fascination with embroidered textiles from there. So all from that one moment of, you know, that leaflet dropping on your feet. So yeah.
So you got all the way through 3 years of university without any real formal needlework experience at all.
Yeah. So I mean, when
and then a leaflet, and then you go right into the Royal School.
Yes, bonkers.
Okay, that's a ride.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was an experience for both me and for the Royal School of Needlework. I don't think they knew what they were taking on either, to be honest. But they rather gamely took me on board. And it was one of those things. When I was little, my mom introduced me to cross stitch, you know, so I'd done like a little cross stitch kit or two, nothing fancy. And then not really experienced embroidery. I'd done a bit of machine embroidery with textiles at secondary school. So I went between the age of 11 and 16. There was textiles that I did, but that was, you know, batik dyeing and, you know, painting of materials and machinery and stitching in with machines. So it was not hand embellishment or anything like that. So it was when at university there was an embroidery module, but it was fabric manipulation. So it was very contemporary, looking at how you manipulate fabrics. And I remember one particularly special evening ruining half of the kitchen utensils by branding fabrics with
But I'll bet that made you popular.
The potato masher was never the same after that. But yeah, it was just this. It was just this thing where I just had that moment where you see something. I've always loved textiles. Like, you know, I was a very tactile child. Always had my fingers up everything. Had to see the world that way and explore the world through touch. And I just had that moment where I saw what they were doing, and how they were doing it. And I just thought, it's just the stars are aligned. It's just one of those things that I just thought, I know where I'm supposed to be. And I didn't know what it was going to take to do it, or how likely was it they were going to take me or otherwise, or, you know, I didn't know about any of those things. I just knew that if I didn't apply, I'd regret it. So, yeah. And it completely changed the course of my life ever since. So in a marvelous way. So yeah, very, very grateful for that, for fate taking a hand there. So,
okay. Two conversations I have to know about. The one with your parents who thought you were about done with school and off to get a job.
Yes.
And then, I've never done needlework. I'm at the Royal School. You should take me into your program.
Yeah. Well, I mean,
you're a salesman more than anything. I'm telling you right now.
Yeah, the gift of the gab. Yeah, no, it was one of those things that I was very open and honest about the fact that, you know, with the RSN that I'd never done stitching before, and they used to take people for the apprenticeship that you'd come from different disciplines and backgrounds, and mostly people, of course, had done embroidery of some kind. But I took my portfolio of design work and I was like, this is my background. I mean, they're clever. The way that they could train monkeys, the way that they train things, the way that they do it is just a well-programmed format. It's just, it's been considered over time and changed over time and continues to still be tweaked and changed here and there to make it the best possible course within the current circumstances. And I think it's fascinating that they can do that, and that we as an organisation, because I still work with them, adapt in that way within such a traditional field, mm-hmm. to try and make it contemporary to the modern setting. But it was that thing where, you know, they knew that my background was not stitch. They knew that they would give me those skills, and I was a complete blank slate as far as that was concerned. And it was a massive learning curve. I didn't even know what finger thimbles went on. In fact, I went, you were given a list of things to take with you as an apprentice on your first day, and thimbles was one of the things on the list. I was going on a day trip with my mom, and there was an embroidery shop nearby to the place that we were going to, and I'd taken my list with me knowing this, and we went in, and my mom, again, we didn't think we knew anybody who was interested in embroidery, so she was trying this title out for the first time. She said, my daughter's got into the Royal School of Needlework for the apprenticeship scheme, and she's got a list of things, and the lady was like, oh, interesting, very good. And I knew nothing about what anything was for or where anything went. And it was just completely.
So you're just faking your way through it.
No, I was just smiling at her like, you know, we need help. And she brought out this box of what looked like a thermidor, you know, like for cigars. Mm-hmm. A humidor, sorry. And I was like, interesting, what's this? And then she'd got out this very shiny array of differently sized thimbles, and I'd never seen anything like this before, so I was like, that's very interesting, because I've got very small fingers. So we managed to find what I thought was the right thimbles, and the lady in the shop looked at me and went, that might fit, but they're the wrong fingers, dear. And I could see her thinking, well, I thought it was a bit mean that she'd let me try them on the wrong fingers in the first place. But you know, I could see her thinking, you know, keep the receipt because you'll be bringing those back.
Right.
You know, but it was one of those things. I always remember it with good humor because it's that thing you have to remember where you've come from and how far you've come.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it doesn't matter what you work on. We're all coming from the same place. So it's such an important lesson to remember and to try to retain your sense of humor and to be a bit humble about it, because you know, we've all had that moment where we've really kind of not known anything but just really wanted to do something, so that's the important thing, wanting to do something. So right. You know, the will to do it. But as far as my parents were concerned, it was, you know, I always say that I kind of won the life lottery with my parents, because my family were they're very competitive people. They're always involved with sports, athletics particularly, which is how my parents met. So they both came from working class backgrounds and worked really hard for everything they'd got and everything they gave us. And it was that thing where they, you know, always said, get a job you'll enjoy because you'll do it a long time. And it's a long time to get out of bed every day dreading the day. But I think they also said train for a role. I think they were thinking, you know, doctor, lawyer,
right,
you know,
right, right.
Teacher, something like that, you know, so
something with a real job.
Yeah, so that lovely title. But I think it's that thing where, you know, because that was their experience, they were, you know, and they always wanted to be so helpful because they wanted to, you know, if you said you were interested in something, they kind of think of somebody they knew that did that or had an interest in that, that could maybe advise you and kind of pass on that knowledge. And they were always very kind of like, community was very important to my family, and particularly my dad. And so he'd always think, how can we help that person achieve mm-hmm. what they want to achieve? And that was the way that we were raised. So it was quite important for them to be able to assist us. So I think one of their main concerns was not the fact that I was going to be studying for another 3 years. I think it was, well, where will that lead to? What will you do with that? Is there a job at the end of it? How can we help you? Because we don't know anybody that does this. Is this a job?
yeah, key, you know, key question.
Completely normal questions, you know, and, you know, when you're in that moment, you're in that excitement of a new revelation, you're kind of, you know, you don't think about those things. You're kind of just so
great.
Blinkers on. So it's very important that somebody's going to stand there and go, okay, can we just sit and think about this for a little bit? So it was really funny because when, I went for my two interviews, my parents came with me, and it was really funny because after the first interview, I came out, and the first interview was really interesting because it was with the principal, who was Elizabeth Elvin at the time, and she had the interview with you. And if you weren't going to get a second interview, you got shown the door. But if you were going to have a second interview, then she'd show you round. And then she'd show you around, and you'd get a chance to chat some of the apprentices and ask you questions of them. And then and she'd take you downstairs and then say, okay, you've seen what we do, you've seen how we do it, have a think for a week, and if you'd like the second interview that I'm offering you, then let us know. But if it's not for you, it's not for everybody, but if it's not for you, then just let us know. And I came out of that interview thinking, I want the second interview. And I went and spoke to my parents, and they were like, okay, so what happens now? And I was like, I've got a second interview. And they were like, oh, okay. So I came to my second interview, and they were like, so what happens now? and I was like, well, I'll wait and hear if I've got the place. And if I've got the place, then I go at the end of August, start of September, and I'm here for 3 years full time, and that's it. You know, so we see what happens. I work like stink and get my apprenticeship. So it was really funny because they were kind of like, okay, then. And then when I got my letter, actually, my letter arrived on my birthday, which was, they'd said, so that it was, the RSM made me laugh because they said that they wouldn't send the letter out to let us know whether we'd got a place or not until after Christmas, so that we wouldn't have a ruined Christmas if we didn't get in. But I actually got my letter on the 21st of December, which is my birthday. So it was the best possible birthday present that year. So I got my place, and my parents, most other people's parents that I've spoken to, their parents were kind of like, oh my goodness, it's amazing, you've got a place. And my parents were like, right, are you sure you want to go? but the thing was, it was this amazing journey for all of us, really, because, you know, I they knew nothing about embroidery either, and I went and took this place up, and which they were concerned about, you know, because they were concerned about the outcome of what it would mean and how it would, you know, this extra 3 years of study would affect my life and going away from home and all of these things, normal parent worries. And right. And it was really lovely because actually, because they're the way that they are, and they're very interested and engaged with what all of us do, they learnt about embroidery as well. So I'd quite often, there's very good fabric markets and things in Birmingham where I'm from. So I'd send, I'd speak to my mom on the telephone and say, "Mom, I need some silk jupey on. It needs to be like a peacock blue." And she'd go with my nan to the fabric market and send fabric in the post. And it was just a wider range than I could afford to purchase through the normal shops. At that point, as an apprentice, you weren't well paid. So it was, you know, it was a fantastic opportunity. But they would then go and get fabric for me and send it. And they were engaged with that. And it was, it was lovely. So it was a learning curve for all of us, but especially for me. So,
well, now that must have been two aspects of going to the Royal School as an apprentice who has never done anything, is you're a blank slate. So there's no bad habits to correct.
Absolutely.
But on the other side, that's a tremendous amount of work to effectively get up to speed, I would think.
I think it's one of those things. I've always been, as I say, quite competitive. So I've decided, you know, we always in our family, if you decide you're going to do something, you're going to do it. I'm very much like a light switch. I'm either interested or disinterested. So so once you've switched your interest onto something, it's, you've got the laser beam of that interest. So it was surely, it was a lot of work. And it's, you're only going to allow it to intimidate you if you're going to say it's too much for yourself. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean? But if you're going to accept the challenge, you're going to take it full on. And as I say, I didn't know what it was going to take to do it. I just knew I was going to do it.
So, okay.
So it was that thing about, you know, it was great in so far as learning to stitch with both hands was no more abnormal for me than stitching with one, because I didn't stitch with one hand, let alone two hands.
Right.
So learning to stitch with thimbles was no more abnormal because I didn't stitch. So it was fantastic in so far as that for me, I was learning the, you know, not so much the correct way, but the RSN way of doing it was the way that, the only way that I knew. So it's afterwards that you start to experiment, and, you know, so I learned the technically correct way of doing things, or the way that the RSN does it is there's lots of ways of doing things. But I always say that the way that the RSN teaches and the RSN technique is the most efficient way of being able to replicate something to the same standard again and again. Mm-hmm. So there's a reason for the way that we teach each stitch and the way that we do. And you can explain what that reason is and why. And for me, knowing why you were doing things in a particular way always helped me remember how to do it.
Yeah.
So the fact that there's reasons for everything and you understand that. And then it's just, is my stitch length too long? Is it too short? Is my tension correct? So it's a process. So you just have to be willing to apply yourself and put the work in. So, and I was really lucky because the year that I was in was an exceptional year. You know, so I had a really good year, and the girl that used to sit next to me in my first year was a lady called Emi Nimura, who is she works in Japan. She's from Japan. She came over from Japan. She was a Japanese. She was a professional bead embroiderer with books published before she came to the RSN. So for me, having her next to me meant that my bar was very high.
Yes.
Because she set the standard. And so for me, I used to come in, initially I'd come in and I'd be, you know, you'd have your full working day at the RSN, and then you go home, make your dinner, do your shopping, do the normal things that you need to do, domesticated things, and then you'd sit for another 4, 5, 6 hours at night doing your homework, getting through some more stuff. And then I'd come in the next day feeling really pleased with myself, thinking, yeah, I've achieved something last night, that's really good, I've moved this forward. And I'd look at hers and I'd think, It's like she's got pixies working through the night. It's like she's got an embroidery team in a apartment, and I genuinely didn't know how she was doing it. But obviously, the more familiar you become with something, the quicker you become, and the more confident you become. And it's about time spent on something, isn't it? So your familiarity and therefore your speed increases. So, and for me, that was actually really, I know that for some people it would have been quite demoralizing, but for me, I kind of thought, okay, well, I know what I'm shooting at. Yeah. It's, you know, when you run a race, I always think, like, when you run a race, it's easier to run quicker when you've got somebody to chase. And that's how I applied myself to embroidery, which sounds really tactical, and it wasn't like that at all. It was, we all got on very, very well. We, in fact, I'm really good friends with pretty much everybody who was in my year. But it, as I say, it just really helped me to have that high bar and that ability to look at pretty much anybody in my year and kind of go, okay, that's great. What can I learn from that? How can I move this forward? How can I apply that to what I'm doing?
Yeah.
And that was brilliant for me. So, yeah.
Well, in those kinds of situations, those mental games are what gets you through it. You know, all right, I'm going to chase the person ahead of me. Of course, choosing a highly skilled Japanese needleworker is, I'm not so sure if that's the smartest move, but.
You know, if
you measure up, you know.
Yeah. As a child, I used to do cross-country running. As a teenager, I used to do cross-country running for quite a high-level athletics club. And you used to work your way, picking your way through the field. Like, okay, I'm chasing that person, and the next person, the next person. And then you look at the end game and you think, okay, well, how did I do against my personal best? How was my speed, like, compared to the last time I did this distance? And it's the same thing. I mean, Emmy sat next to me, so she was the person who I was looking at the most. Do you know, so what she was working on and how she was working was the most familiar to me. But then I also shared a house with a really skilled embroiderer called Jen Goodwin as well, who was in my year, and she, we're the best of mates even now, and it's brilliant because we'd kind of compare things, and I'd kind of be sitting there at night working on saying, can I be like, I haven't got a clue what I'm doing. And I'd knock on a door and go, Jen, like, can you remember how to do this? Or I've completely lost myself on that. Or she did the same. And we'd kind of bounce off each other. And it was just such a brilliant process. And as I say, you were just engaged with it, absolutely immersed in it 24/7.
Yeah.
And I think it was completely necessary to be like that, because it just embedded the absolute love of it. You know, it's going to either make or break you to live that life. It's like an endurance camp for 3 years.
Right.
And for me, it completely embedded that obsession. Yeah,
because that's the exactly what was going through my mind is, in that situation, you either go left or right. And,
oh, yeah.
And left is out the door. I can't stand this. Or you just bury yourself and it becomes part of you.
Yeah, I mean, it completely, I always think it's a bit like a stick or rock. If you cut me through the middle, then you'll see embroidery kind of through the core. It's, yeah, there's probably some threads running through there, but it's, but it's so essential, because to be able to work in this field professionally, in whatever aspect, that there's so many directions you can take it in, to be prepped for that through one course, to be able to kind of be prepared and be ready to go out and face those challenges in whatever field, part of the field that is, that's a massive thing to do. And you have to work like stink to get there. And mentally, you are going to, if you're working in a studio, for example, and you're working on commissions, you're potentially going to be working very, very long hours. You're going to potentially be sleep deprived at times, depending on the job and time that you've got. You're going to have to work, you know, those conditions don't make you a very pleasant, you know, person. You know, you start to get crotchety, so you have to be able to work with other people effectively within that field and be able to work in a way that's acceptable, you know. So it's all of those things. It's about training yourself to a point where you can be professional and you can approach things, still be yourself, but still bring something to the team that's the flavor of you, but also be able to work within those conditions. And I think, you know, you have to have a realistic outlook. You have to be able to have an insight into that job and go, is this for me? Am I going to be able to, you know, when you're charging it as a professional embroiderer who's working on, you know, in a studio, for example, you're working by the hour, you know. So if you're very slow or take a time to ponder every stitch that you put in, then you're not going to be commercially viable compared to the person, somebody else that could do it. So it has to have a brutal reality to it. you know? You know, for you to be able to know you can do it as a job, or what part of it you want to take forward as a job, whether it's the teaching side, whether it's the stitching side, whether it's the designing and making new things, is it kits? There's so many things to do, but you have to have the ability to have that honest response, both from somebody else and from yourself, because, you know, you have to be able to be honest with yourself about what you can do and want to do. You know, so yeah, you're right. It's that you'd have that crossroads moment where you're like, this is for me. This is 100% where I'm going. Or no, this is 100% not for me. I've enjoyed it, but no, time's done.
Yep. So. Yeah. And you best make the right decision there, because,
yeah, I think so. So but then, it was very much set in the fire, isn't it? You're molded in the fire. You're kind of like, if you can experience that and come out with a love of it, I'd still want to do it. Nothing's going to be as hard as that.
Oh yeah, there's no question about that. Yeah, if you still love it after that, yep, yeah, you're good.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Exactly.
So what's the transition now after you finish your schooling there? You stayed on and taught. Yeah, how did you transition out of that?
Well, I've always taught for the RSN. I really feel passionately about that. I've taught for the RSN and for other places. And I really, you know, because of the opportunity that they gave me to learn, I want other people to be able to have that enjoyment, to have those skills at their fingertips, and to understand all the different aspects that you can give you, whether even if they're only learning one aspect, whether it's relaxation or mindfulness, or whether it's, you know, the joy of seeing something being created. I love that. And passing on those skills is so important. So for me, I always love that. I love spending time with people and getting those skills out there and sharing that with people, regardless of age, background, whatever they want to do with it. I want them to know it. So that was really important. So I always did that with the RSN and other places. But when I finished my apprenticeship, when I graduated, I was just aware that, you know, you could apply to stay at the studio and work in the studio as an embroidery stitcher within the studio. But I didn't do that because I was aware that it was a very safe environment. But at that time, if you're an embroidery stitcher, you weren't involved in the pricing or the quoting or for any of that side of it. So I knew that there was a lot that I didn't know. And I knew that at that point I'd got no responsibilities. And it was that thing, I don't know what I don't know. You have to go and try it to find out what you need to learn. So I decided at that point to go freelance, to get a normal part-time job to pay some bills, and to go and see what I didn't know.
This is the part where your parents are cheering loudly.
bless them. They actually, because I said I was going to be going back home, we always used to joke I was a boomerang baby, but, you know, I was very fortunate to get on with my family very well. So they kind of like, they always had an open door policy, and they were like, as long as we can see you're working as hard as you can at what you want to be, we'll support you. As soon as you're dossing around, you, that's where we start to cut the support line. And I think that's so important, because I think they'd got things that they would have liked to do when they were younger, and they financially, their situation was not, it was not able to support that. So for them, they wanted to be able to support their kids, to be able to chase their dreams, as long as they were working, you know, as long as they weren't pie in the sky. I mean, as long as they were like, as long as you weren't like, I'd like to be an astronaut tomorrow. You know, it needed to be realistic, and you needed to be able to show them that you'd got a plan, that you were working towards something, and that you were working hard. Whilst they could see that, within reason, they'd support you. So I came home, got a normal job. I was working in a shop, and they did the rotas every week, so I'd just be able to say, okay, next week I'm not available Wednesday, but I'm available the other days, or however many days I got freelance work doing embroidery, I could tell them. And and they were really great, because they were like, well, as long as you're here and doing your job, you know, 100% when you're here, we don't mind what you're doing all the rest of the time. So I went off and I was doing freelancing, and I was doing teaching and making and designing some kits and doing all sorts of things and doing some embroidery commissions. And it was during that period that I got approached. I'd been freelance about 10 months, and I got approached by an auction house, big international auction house called Bonhams. And I'd spoken to them about whether they needed any kind of, whether any clients needed any restoration or conservation work. And they kind of contacted me and said, Yeah, we can do that. But did you know we've got this post available at the moment, and we think you might be quite a good fit for it. So they kind of, I had a conversation with them, and it was the funniest job interview ever because they were kind of like, okay, tell us why you'd be perfect for the post of head of tech sales and costume. And I was like, I haven't got a clue. I've never been to an auction house before. I was never been to an auction, never been to an auction house. It's not a job I applied for. You told me about this job. What is the job? Tell me what the job is. What does it entail? So it turned into this really funny interview. And in the end, we had this brilliant conversation, and I never forget. It was a lovely man called Robert Bleasdale, who I'm still friends with. He runs brilliant sewing tool sales, Bleasdale's Auctions, and antique sewing tools. And we had this brilliant conversation, and he took so much time and care to be able to explain it to me, and took me under his wing really, and really made me open my eyes to that side of things. So I'd got a lot of skills and knowledge already that did make me well suited for the job, but I really needed to learn how to separate the amount of time and care somebody had taken into something away from how to price something to the current market value or auction and things, how to do probate valuations, all these kind of things. So he very kindly took me under his wing and taught me some of those things. And so I found myself in a department of an auction house, describing and valuing, cataloguing and organizing catalogs for sales for textiles and costume, and then doing telephone bids and all of those types of things after sales, and then
Well,
the things that I didn't know
that's an
about.
interesting mental process there,
Yeah.
knowing embroidery as you did at that point and what goes
Yeah.
into it, but then what is its market value?
Yeah, I think it was really interesting. It was a bit of an interesting segue off the main event for me. So it kind of it was something that an opportunity that came forward that I thought, well, I hadn't considered this before. Again, it's that process of loving to learn. I could see how it related really strongly to my field. And being able to see these antique textiles every day, and to see these amazing collections, and to really learn about my field in a different way. And so it was a completely different sidestep. So it took me down a path that I hadn't expected. Really, really enjoyed it. And as I say, one of the amazing things was that there were lots of things in this department. So lace making and all sorts of things came under the department, fans and, Chinese textiles, things that are very specialised that I knew nothing about. So I had consultants that I could then bring in to consult about these particular things that would come in. And so I was learning with them. They were very generous with their knowledge, with teaching me about things and what to look for. And so it was just a really good period of learning for me as well. So a great opportunity, and I went into it. And as I say, I think I spent kind of 3 4 years there, and really kind of enjoyed it, but also was getting really itchy fingers towards the end to be making again, because I was seeing these amazing things and I'd be so inspired. And then because it was a full-time job and I was traveling around for it and all sorts, you didn't have the energy at the end of the day to apply yourself to making, designing the way that you would have wanted to. So to have an outpouring for that creativity. So in the end, I dealt with a big record-breaking sale. There was an export ban on it. There was all sorts of things, and I thought, things aren't going to, the beauty about this field is that it's you age like a fine wine. The more that the more valuable you become. So but having said that, I just really felt strongly that I needed to go back into the making sector. So I kind of took a rather brave choice and leapt into being an atelier manager. So I became atelier manager of Hand and Lock in central London. And so I was running their studios, which dealt with the theatre and fashion and film and one-off commissions and things. So it was a complete leap into a different field, because having gone from the auction house, where you were dealing with the price, the perceived value of something, including its age over time and the kind of collector's market, the trends in the collector's market of what was attractive and what was collectible and why. You were then moving into having to estimate for jobs based on how long it's going to take. Again, you know, all the different facets of making a process, the prices involved with that, the materials, the threads, and profit, and quoting for that, training the team if there was things that we needed to look at skills wise, you know, okay, what can I teach that person? What can that person teach this other person? How do we keep those skills up? And checking that we were maintaining targets on time within the workroom and quality within the workroom. So it was a completely different set of challenges. So yeah, completely fascinating alteration again. So,
but this path that you've taken, learning needlework, and then appraising and determining market value, and then doing this really gives you all the aspects that you need for what you're doing today.
Yeah, I mean, without knowing it, I was kind of like building quite a full repertoire of knowledge. And it enabled me, having been at Hand & Lock, I think just over a year, I'd had some personal life changes, and I thought, okay, where do I want to be? What do I want to be doing? How do I want to spend my time? Mm-hmm. And I realized that actually my aim eventually had always been to go freelance, to be able to pursue all the different facets that interested me the most. So I had learned what I felt I needed to learn to be able to do that properly. So the first time I'd been freelance, it was kind of testing your teeth to see what you didn't know, to see what you needed to know.
Sure.
Seeing what you needed to learn and what skills you needed to pick up. By this point, I felt, this was 2008, and I felt like I'd got sufficient skills to be able to go freelance with the confidence and knowledge of being able to feel like I could support that properly. You know, I had different skills to those which I came out of the RSN with, and I felt like I had a different approach and outlook entirely. So I'd kind of added to those skills and felt like I was ready for that. So now it's really interesting because, you know, all the different facets that I find interesting, people always find it really strange that, you know, I'm interested in the history and research of it. I'm interested in the technical making skills. I'm interested in the teaching, and they find them quite disparate, but to me, they all link together really strongly. So, again, as I say, I love to spend my time with people and talking to people and finding out about how they respond to embroidery and what they want to do with it and where they want to take it and teaching them those skills. But then I also really love to spend time in a solitary manner designing, you know, getting completely immersed in the stitching process. So to me, it's a really good balance of those things and aspects that I need to pursue and the things that I need out of a job. So
you find equal satisfaction in both?
Yeah, absolutely. I think for me, it's very much yin and yang. You need the balance. I need the balance of that. So I couldn't spend my time 24/7 in people's company. But then I couldn't be on my own 24/7 either. It's that thing about needing both aspects to feel like a complete circle. So for me, it all really balances itself off. And it gives me everything that I need from a job. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it's really important.
So when it comes to design time, complete immersion, like shut the world out?
Yeah, I mean, I really enjoy that process where you can kind of get your head into that. Like, so designing was one of my first loves, really, because I think it's, you know, the way that you see the world, but your brain playing with the way that you see the world. So you know, I love to design. So for me, it's quite a straightforward process. I really enjoy immersing myself into it, and it comes quite easily to me because I've got that background and I've trained in it and I love it. I feel very comfortable with it, but it's sometimes the challenge is more than anything because things feel complete in your head. So you can imagine quite a full manner once I've got an outline on paper, I can imagine what the colours are going to be like. I can imagine what the texture is going to be like. So for me, the challenge is sometimes to make sure that I push through to the completion point where it actually is finished in fabric, because
it's in your head, so you're good to go. Yeah.
To me, it's a really beautiful thing. So sometimes you have to think, no, actually, this needs to be out in the world rather than just on the inner world. It's sometimes that's the challenge, because as I say, retaining your interest all the way through to the completion of that project, because as I say, the inner world's quite beautiful already.
So, it's perfect, yeah. Folks, trust me, if you could just see it.
Yeah, exactly. But I think as well, it's that thing about knowing why you're doing something as well, because you know, I'll quite often pursue within classes that I teach or kits that I create, I'll quite often pursue things that I'm interested in or techniques that I've taken my attention at that particular time. So that's really good because it gives me a purpose to make that a finished thing in the outer world. Whereas sometimes, as I say, the perceived thing in the inner world in your brain, you think, okay, do I need to share that with people? You know, as I say, it's that, you know, how much of it is because it is a job and you're wanting to earn money or you're wanting to please somebody or it's for a particular thing for somebody or a commission, and how much of it is just something that you've imagined that's pleased you in that moment. So I think, as I say, some of it, I'll just come up with stuff and I'll start doodling and I'll be like, oh, that's really nice. And I'll kind of like play with that. And then, I mean, I've got a drawers full of designs that will never ever be completed, you know, because you can't complete everything, because embroidery is, you know, in relative terms slow, designing is quick. So it's one of those things that I'm really fortunate, because I've got a couple of people who very, very kindly actually have volunteered to stitch a few things, because we had this conversation a while ago and they were like, that's such a shame, these things need to be out there. And I'm like, I've not got time to stitch everything that right. I imagine. So you have to be choosy about what you're putting out. So so I've now got a couple of people who've kind of gone, okay, some of the things that you enjoy that you maybe wouldn't have stitched right. initially, like send me some pictures or send me a stitch plan, or you know, so I've got a couple of ladies who do that, which is really pleasing, because actually sometimes you do get surprised, because you think, oh, you know, how I imagined it, sometimes the way they interpret a stitch plan might be slightly different, so mm-hmm. or the slight color variations or shade variations that they put in. So so I'll get these pieces back and it'll just be a beautiful surprise. And and it's lovely, because actually, you know, it's that moment where you can disengage yourself right. from the initial design and the design process. And because somebody else has stitched it, you kind of have that moment where it's a surprise when you open the box and you're kind of like, oh, okay. So you see it with fresh eyes.
Right, exactly. So,
yeah. Whereas when you're stitching it yourself, you become so immersed in it, you almost become snowblind to a point. Mm-hmm. Because you it's that point at which your imagination and your reality merge. So how much of it, I think sometimes when people stitch, sometimes you miss things, because, you know, if you miss mistakes or whatever else, because your imagination has smoothed over those, because right. you know what you imagine it's going to be like.
Exactly.
So
yeah.
That's why it's always sometimes good with designs, you know, as put them up. If there's something that I kind of think, I'm not sure if that's finished, I kind of put it up and I'll live with it for a little while. I'll put it on the wall, or I'll put it upside down so I can kind of think about it in a set of shapes rather than the ideas that I had imagined originally. So if it works as a set of shapes, then it's finished.
Yeah.
So
it's interesting to me to hear you describe that, because as a magazine editor, I when I'm editing a piece, you know, and there's a very distinct difference between a writer and an editor. And when I edit a piece, that's my standard practice, is I'll edit it, go through it a couple of times, and then it goes away. I mean, in the pressures of deadlines force it to go away for no more than a day. But it's all right. I think that's finished, but I need to come back to it with fresher eyes and a fresher head. Yeah. And so you set it aside, and then later on you come back, and that's when you see the other things.
Exactly.
That your mind is glossed over, right?
Exactly the same.
Yeah.
So
and yeah,
I
you need
also
that. You need that process, and that's what gets you closer to the end product. Yes.
Yeah, I would say that when I'm teaching as well. You know, when people have spent a long time stitching something, they become so enmeshed with it. It's really fascinating when you can have that moment where you kind of go, okay, you know, I would say we like canvas work, for example. You'll have a day where you're kind of like, we call it hedgehog day. So where I'll be sitting there literally putting pins in where they've missed a stitch. And they'll be like, I don't think there's any. I've stitched all of it. It's all covered. And you'll be like, uh-huh, okay. Well, let me just take a look, real close look at it. So I'll sit down with a box of pins, and then they'll kind of be like, you know, an assortment of pins all over the place. And I'll be like, how have I missed all of these stitches? And like, because you weren't looking for them.
Right.
You know, to you, it's completed, and that's how it should be. Like, but you need that eye to just scan it to make sure that you have, you know, covered it all, that it's all looked completely smooth, that there's no drops. And and it's really interesting. You know, I think it's a perfect example of that. So, yeah.
Hedgehog day. I love that.
Okay. Hedgehog day.
Oh no, I'm awful. Start over.
Yeah. Well, I think it's that thing because we, I always kind of like share examples of things where when I first started, and because it was such a steep learning curve for me, there were things that I kind of misunderstood or dropped the ball on or whatever else. And that was just another challenge to kind of come past. But I always kind of joke with my students about those moments, and because I think sometimes people think that you come out of, you go into the RSN, you know, fully spawned as an embroiderer, and you just go out as a better version of that. and of course that isn't the case, and it wasn't the case for me certainly. And I think it's really good for people to know that process and to be able to share those stories and to know that that's normal. So yeah.
So what does your business look like today? What, I mean, it's multifaceted, there's no question. What all it goes on in, you know, a month's period of time?
There's no standard day, which is good. I mean, obviously in lockdown, it's weird, but normally in normal life, there's no standard day. I mean, I spend about a week and a half of every month normally in Scotland, teaching and lecturing. So I teach at an assortment of places. So I work for the Royal School of Needlework. I'm in the Scottish branch up there from Glasgow, from the art club. I teach for the Wem School of Needlework. I work with the Royal Collection at Holyrood Palace in Edinburgh, which is you know, an amazing opportunity. So I try and meet as wide and varied a group of people as possible, and engage with the heritage that I love, you know. So for me, things like working at the portrait galleries or working at the National Gallery or working at Holyrood, it's because it's in that setting where you can see historic artifacts, where you can see historic textiles, or you can see representations of them in portraits. So for me, it really gives it that lovely full circle to be able to see things in context. Mm-hmm. And to share that context with people. But so that's kind of a week and a half to a week of every month. I spend a lot of time designing and making new kits, whether that's for classes or whether that's for retail. I spend a lot of time. I do also do restoration aspects of conservation for people. So I do some of those. So commissions come in for that. And then commissions also for theatre, film, one-off bespoke pieces for people that they want to have. So, yeah, but I think also kind of fielding a lot of questions. So people kind of like, the more you're kind of out there, the more people kind of use you as a sounding post.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of like asking advice on threads or fabrics or, you know, so there's some of that goes on as well. So yeah, it's a real mixture. And I've been doing some work with trying to develop some things with children at the moment. So during lockdown, one of the things that I've been doing is thinking about how children respond to embroidery or how they would respond to embroidery. So I've been kind of developing some things that I want to do as lockdown eases here. So I've been thinking about that a lot as well. So how we kind of get what I love to the next generation. So I've always done stuff in schools and special projects in schools, but trying to get an engagement with people outside of a school setting, children outside of a school setting as well. So, but yeah, I mean, one of the things that I've been looking at in lockdown is, apart from doing a lot of stitching and designing, I've been working out a new website, which is coming out shortly, and just trying to master online things, really. So I think there's always an element where I think training as a hand embroiderer, there's probably a large proportion of us that are slightly of the Luddite kind of persuasion. So I have both admiration and awe of people who are fully au fait with all of the systems on how to make things work online and how to get things up and running. And I've been kind of slowly learning. So it's been a process for me. So I really love social media as a way of engaging with a wide proportion of people. So I've been trying to learn more about that and engaging with that, but also kind of thinking about how you want, you know, as you move forward, what your legacy is. So, you know, I think of all things, people at the moment are thinking about, you know, well, mundane things also, but, you know, where to get bread. But it's, you know, people are thinking more increasingly about, you know, what is it that you leave behind? So I think I've been considering that quite a lot as well. I think about how that changes how I move forward, and, you know, also who you can reach out to during these times. Because obviously, normally when people are taught by me, they come and they are in a physical place. I physically see them. So, and that obviously working online changes the way that you can engage. So, I've been kind of looking and experimenting with that as well. So that's an interesting kind of change, really. So it's, you know, I've been thinking about how that kind of, how you embark on that in a way that you maintain your standards and that you, the person feels that they're getting a connection with you as well. So I think that's one of the things that people want from embroidery. It's about learning something, it's about satisfaction of having a skill, moving your skill forward, but it's also about that connection. Right. I think that's really important. So I've been kind of experimenting with that whilst we've been in lockdown. So it's been quite a valuable time. I mean, whilst obviously not ideal, far from ideal, rather stressful on many fronts. You know, you have to see it as an opportunity as well. It's the way that you engage with anything, isn't it? It's an opportunity to learn something about myself, learn some new skills, so change direction if possible in a different way. So
yeah, we've been having discussions in more than one show recently about the online technology and how it's changing and going to change, I think, long term needlework and the way people are instructed and the way they learn, but also access that they have to teachers, designs, schools that would not normally be accessible. And I think that there's a real upside long term for needlework just because of this, people being forced to continue on with businesses by learning technology and how to do things online. I think that will carry out and end up being a real silver lining out of this thing.
I think you're absolutely right. I mean, I think, you know, diversification is massively important. And I think it is that thing where, you know, I've done community work as well, because I think it's important that, you know, people are able to access knowledge affordably as well. So, you know, this does mean that you can have a look at the prices that you're paying for something. So, you know, when you come down to the brass tacks of it, you know, if I'm having to travel somewhere, not only are they having to pay for my costs of tuition, but they're having to, within that cost, there has to be my financial costs have to be met. So, you know, if I've had to travel somewhere, if I've had to stay somewhere, if I've had to be fed, you know, so those things are taken away when you're working from your studio or working from home, you know, so it becomes more accessible price wise to a much broader range of people. And I think it's been really interesting because the amount of people who've contacted me because they've had a realization at home as well as, you know, the amount of people who contacted me during this period who have said, you know, when this is done, can you do some beginners things? Can you do some things for people who've never picked up a needle before or haven't picked one up in years? Because I've just realized I don't have a hobby that either I don't have a hobby or I don't have a hobby I can do indoors because I'm normally part of a team and I'm outside normally, or, you know, it's one of those things. So, you know, something that they can do inside the house. So it's been quite an interesting moment, I think, for everybody to have a real reflection on what they want to spend their time on and how they want to spend their time and what they normally do. And let's face it, there's only so much Netflix you can watch.
Right. Well, that was a thing a friend of mine who has two teenage daughters posted on some social media somewhere. They were setting up a trampoline in the backyard. And he said the kids have found the end of the internet. And now we have to do something else.
And there's no Wizard of Oz at the end of it. It comes to a grinding halt, yeah.
Yeah, and it's, Yeah, now what?
Yeah, it's it is. And I think this, when you get to saturation point, and I think it's really interesting that how quickly some people got to saturation point and how long it's taken others, you know, and everyone's on their own path. And I think it's really fascinating, you know, as I say, as the weeks and months have progressed, just the sheer amount of people have been kind of like, okay, I'm done with this now. I need something else. Can we do this? Can we do that? So it's been really interesting, as I say. And you know, as you know, embroidery is always something, it's a good opportunity to talk. So, you know, that opening out of conversations and even just, you know, WhatsApp groups or, you know, messenger groups or groups on Zoom or whatever of students that I've taught over time that are sitting at home and that, you know, they've got nobody at home with them and they need some interaction. So these people are all creating groups with each other so that they can get together. And it's like, you know, they'll sit in stitching company or they'll just even arrange 15 minutes where they'd have, you know, a tea break, like what would be a normal coffee break in a class. They're getting together and kind of chatting as they would in a normal coffee break. And then they're going off on their day another 15, you know, they've had 15 minutes out to kind of interact with people in a way that is more normal, you know? So I think it's brilliant. I mean, it's making us all think, isn't it? So.
Yeah. Oh, it is. Mm. Yes, it really is. It's making everybody stop. Yep. Good long-term. It's just too bad it has to be such an ugly thing that causes it.
Well, this is it. I mean, there's obviously a terrible, terrible cost. And I think, you know, it's only when things are truly so awful that you do have a realization. You do have that moment where you kind of stop and really assess what you want and what you want to be doing, spending your time with, and what's important to you, isn't it? So if everything was slightly more normal, you'd still be floating along doing your normal, normal life. I think actually, it is absolutely awful. It's scary and these are scary times, but you get out of it what you can, don't you? So yes. I think it's I had a conversation with my mom towards the start of lockdown, and you know, she's in her 70s now, so she's shielding, and which I don't know if is a phrase you have there, but she's spending time not going out anywhere, not going outside, and so we've been doing a shopping and living on a doorstep and things, and you know, she was finding it very difficult. And so I was having this conversation about the fact that so many arts organisations have put their work online now, and that you can engage with that and that you can control by shielding, you can control what you're taking on board. Mm-hmm. So you can control what you're looking at and how that makes you feel, and whether that's depressing and whether you're watching the news every day or whether you're watching, you know, wall-to-wall news and looking at how dire it is, or whether you're actually creating a bubble of a different kind for yourself, whether you're engaging with all the things that you don't normally have time for. So, you know, the Broadway shows that are on at the moment online, or whether it's films or audiobooks or, you know, all of the amazing things that, you know, the creative people have put out there, many of which they're doing free of charge. And I think it's just, you know, in that real generous way that, you know, creatives do, trying to make things feel a bit better.
Yeah.
So it's I thought it was really interesting because I saw a thing in the newspaper today and it was saying about what is classed as an essential job and what is classed as a non-essential job. And number one, with 71% of the vote of what is non-essential, was artist. And I thought, this is interesting because your lovely illustrations in your chart have been created by an artist, as has your layout for your quiz. And I think quite often we misunderstand what we mean by artist, and the fact that the creatives are everywhere and they've affected everything you see, sit on, look here, that it's all around you and people forget that. And I think it impacts everybody's life so greatly. And it's that thing that the things that give you joy in life were made by creatives.
Yeah, we probably don't need a Rembrandt right at the moment, but artists, yeah, they're essential, right?
And I think it's really interesting, people forget that. So that they think creativity is low on the needed scale. Don't get me wrong. I mean, I wouldn't go to an embroiderer if I'd got COVID and needed treating. So, I'd go to a doctor for that. But the way that I'm going to get there is in a car that's been designed by somebody. Everything I've got on my back has been designed by somebody and made by somebody. And all of the equipment they're going to use has been designed and made by somebody who's creative. So I think it's that thing about questioning what a real job is, isn't it? Is it a real job? Yes, it is a real job.
Very much. All right, so what is on the horizon for you? What do people look for to interact with you and learn from you?
Right, so on the horizon. Well, I mean, there's some nice things. I've been doing, I did a lovely project last year where I went to Norway and was filmed embroidering, recreating a piece, an embroidered piece from their collection, which was a silk portrait of King Christian. And so they asked me to go along because they've created a new super museum there, which has combined four of their national museums into one building, one big super building, which is going to be the largest of its type in the Scandinavian region. And they're highlighting, I think it's a really interesting project because what they've done is quite often museums and galleries, you see art, but you don't hear about the artist. And so they're engaging with that making as well as the end product. So they've taken a lot of different fields of different artifacts and techniques of making and tried to create films of people using those skills now, how that's relevant, how it was made in the first place, how that's changed. So they've created these really interesting films to go in the galleries, buy the pieces, but also on their multimedia, on their websites, and on their things that they can engage with, people engage with in the gallery. So that will be opening at some point this year, hopefully. And, depending on what the impact of COVID has been on the making process there. But yeah, so that will be opening, and their stuff will be going online, as will all the kind of film stuff that I've done for them. Other things that I'm going to be doing, I currently do things for shopping channels. So the one that I'm working with at the moment is Hachanda. So it's a really good way of getting free tuition for people who want to engage with embroidery, and you can purchase kits through them. But as I say, I do tuition when I'm there, so I'll demonstrate particular techniques and I try to make them different each time I'm there. So that's really good. So you can see it on their program if you watch them live, or you can call them back on YouTube. I also quite often put their the recordings on my YouTube as well. So it's very easy to find my YouTube. You just search my name, which is Helen McCook. So it's a cook with an MC on the front. And
Yeah,
and
and
then
just those videos, and we're going to run out of time here, and I want to explore that whole experience with you. So that means you have to come back. So that's how that works.
Not a problem, not a
But
problem.
yeah, watch those. They're fun to watch.
Oh, thank you.
As they, I mean, they are as a needleworker in terms of the instruction you offer, but then also fun to watch just as a TV show.
We try and make them quite relaxed. There's different formats, but some are more formalized, some are more relaxed and informal, where you'll kind of have a bit more of a conversational backdrop to what you're doing. But yeah, we try and also get some education in there so people can see those skills and learn something each time it's on. And we do try and engage where people, you know, some of the programs, people can send in questions or ask for advice on things. So we try and engage with that as well.
Yes.
Yeah, so I'm hoping to do a bit more of that solo as well on my YouTube and through my website. As I say, I'm sorting my website out at the moment, but people will be able to search for that just by searching my name, Helen McCook. My website should then come up. And just ongoing teaching. You can find me on Instagram, just all under the same name, or Facebook. But I put a lot of stuff out there, kind of where it's relevant. Moving forward, I've been designing and making more kits as well, some more retail kits. It's something I always used to design for classes, but now I've started to do the retail kits as well, because people have been asking them for them, mm-hmm. for years, and I've kind of been always so immersed in other parts. You know, there's only so many things you can do in a day. So I've started to engage with that more as well, because it does reach a wider audience.
Yes.
In a more immediate way. So that's the type of thing I'm doing at the moment and moving forward. But yeah, and also got a very large project, because the Commonwealth Games are coming to Birmingham in 2022. So I'm working on a very large public community set of textile hangings telling the story of Birmingham as a microcosm of the Commonwealth. So looking at different cultures and people within the city, how that reflects on the wider world. There's some really exciting things coming up.
Yeah. You know, Helen, you're easily the most boring individual I've ever talked to. Easily.
Oh, I apologize, Gary.
Yep.
You have to stay interested. The day that you're not interested is, and you're not learning, is the day that you may as well curl up and die. That's what I say.
Yeah, good point. All right, Helen, thanks so much. That was a blast. Really enjoyed hearing from all of that.
Absolute pleasure. Yeah. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, enjoyed it. Thanks, everybody, for listening. And thanks to the EGA and Sassy Jacks for sponsoring the show.